If you just look at the numbers, the economy is in the midst of a recovery. Yet millions of jobless Americans still aren't feeling the uptick. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is holding a summit today to talk about creating more jobs. The chamber has been critical of Obama administration policies, saying they hurt business. NPR's Tamara Keith tracked down a couple of small business owners to ask them why they aren't hiring.
Ask John Brinson why he isn't adding employees, and the answer is surprisingly simple.
We don't need new employees.
And why doesn't he need them?
You don't hire people just to hire people. You know, you hire them because you need them. And we don't need them because business is not good enough.
Brinson is in the fitness business. He owns four clubs in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley. 2 years ago, Brinson's business was booming. Then Lehman Brothers failed. The entire financial system teetered on collapse, and the trouble reached all the way to Allentown, Pennsylvania.
The bottom fell out. People got scared.
And some canceled their memberships. Brinson's business is down 20%. But instead of letting employees go, he got them all to agree to a 10% pay cut. He'd like to restore their wages. And he says he'll do that before adding new positions.
What we're selling, which is fitness, most people do not consider essential. Other things come first. So they're not going to buy from us until the economy gets better. So we're just hanging on and hoping it's going to get better.
A recent survey from the National Federation of Independent Business backs this up. According to the trade group, owners of small businesses say weak sales are their biggest problem. Few have any plans to hire in coming months. And that's not a good sign for the recovery, since these small businesses create the majority of new jobs. Brooke Rush is coated in a mix of sweat and sawdust. He owns a construction company in southeastern Pennsylvania that specializes in custom homes and remodels. This job is a big one, replacing a roof, but he hasn't built a custom home in 3 years. In better times, he'd have four or five guys working for him. Now he has just two.
The work just wasn't there, and I didn't see it coming. The calls had dropped off, so the phones weren't ringing. Sometimes we just call ourselves just to make sure the phones are still working.
Rush has been in this business for 32 years, so he's been through recessions before.
This is different. I've never seen people so reluctant to spend money. My customers, they're like the stock market. They don't like uncertainty.
And as far as Rush is concerned, uncertainty is at an all-time high.
The real issue is just the psychology of it's just being uncertain. We live in very uncertain times. I mean, there's all this stuff going on in Washington. It's just, and people don't know what's going to happen.
His list of concerns includes health care reform and the Bush-era tax breaks that are set to expire later this year.
I worry tremendously about that.
Rush says it doesn't look like he'll have enough work to bring on another employee anytime soon, maybe in a year or two. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
The economic crisis has thrown into high relief cracks in the European Union. This week, we're looking at the EU 5 decades after its founding, and this morning, a defining ideal that's kept it together, its social support system. Some call it the European welfare state. Among EU nations, there is a shared belief that the government has a responsibility to care for its citizens. The European welfare system, largely put in place during the growth years following World War II, is now under enormous pressure, as Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Anders Dalsager and Margit Larsen are graduate students at the University of Copenhagen. Like all Danish students, they study for free and receive a monthly stipend equivalent to about $900 from the government. The couple is married, and today they're picking up their 2.5-year-old daughter, Astrid, from the campus kindergarten.
Hi, Astrid.
Dalsager and Larsen say they were able to afford having a child, even though they don't yet have jobs, because the government also gives them a child care subsidy.
As a regular student, you get 5 years of support, and then if you have a child, you get the extra support from the government, 12 months if it's the mother, and 6 months if it's the father.
Oh, no!
600 miles to the south, in Paris, Marie-Thèse David is also picking up a child from preschool. David immigrated to France from the Philippines 20 years ago. Today she works as a nanny. When David finally got her residency, it came with automatic coverage under France's extensive health care system. David says that has been a blessing because of her chronic asthma.
Mostly every summer I had to go to the emergency room because I can't breathe in the summer. They look after you until you're okay. For me, everything is free for medicine, doctors, hospital. It's nice to live here.
Both the Danish students and this Philippine nanny are supported by the European Union's generous social welfare system. While the model and level of benefits varies from country to country, as a general rule, Europeans enjoy free health care, long-term unemployment support, liberal vacation time, and solid maternity and child care benefits.
The European welfare system has been an important element of European identity, and I would say one of the great comparative advantages of Europe, if not in economic terms, at least in social and human terms.
That's Dominique Moisy, political analyst with the French Institute for International Relations. Moisy says the welfare state has provided a buffer against the economic crisis, protecting Europeans from the kind of suffering Americans have gone through. That may be true, says Nicolas Doze, an economic commentator with a popular French business channel. But without major reforms, Doze says the European Union will not be able to maintain its vision of a kinder, gentler way of life.
Le système social qui est très généreux.
Our social system in France alone has accumulated more than 100 billion euros in debt, and it just isn't viable anymore. Today it survives thanks to one thing, France's AAA credit rating and our ability to keep borrowing to pay for the social programs.
Doze says the Greek debt crisis has pushed European governments to do more to reduce spending in the last 10 weeks than they have in the last 10 years. The markets have put a revolver to our head, he says. Indeed, governments from Germany to Spain are pushing through austerity plans and spending cuts to try to reduce national debts and rein in public spending. But these reforms are being met with resistance, and not just in Greece. Germans are angry about cuts in social spending. And in France, hundreds of thousands of workers have taken to the streets in recent weeks to protest President Nicolas Sarkozy's plans to raise the retirement age from 60 to 62. The French government says workers must stay on the job longer to keep the state pension system afloat, but protesters here say there is plenty of money if you tax the bankers and stockbrokers instead of bailing them out. François Coudeur began working at the age of 17, laying underground cable in hazardous conditions for state-run France Telecom. The company has since been privatized. Coudeur says the rules of the game changed mid-course, and it's the workers who are paying the price.
We came into the company with a clear contract to work 40 years and retire. Now the closer we get to retirement, they say, no, you need to go a little longer. Will they keep adding years? If it's all to retire into a hospice or a wheelchair, what's the point?
A large percentage of social spending in the European Union goes toward supporting labor market policies like unemployment benefits and pension systems, says economist Willem Adema with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development.
With the dynamics of aging population and the increase in life expectancy and with the financial pressures, raising retirement ages is going on across many different European countries.
Another problem for the EU, says Adema, is the rigidity of its labor market, which has inhibited the economic growth necessary to sustain the welfare state. Growth in the eurozone is only expected to reach 1% in 2010, compared to 3% in the U.S. Denmark and its Nordic neighbors have the most extensive cradle-to-grave protection systems in the European Union. They also pay the highest taxes. But the streets of Copenhagen bustle with well-off and happy-looking people. Denmark also has one of Europe's lowest unemployment rates, around 5%. That's largely because of a system called Flex Security that gives employers the freedom to hire and fire, while the state supports laid-off workers with generous benefits and training.
We have a very dynamic, innovative business sector, but it's facilitated and enabled by strong public institutions.
That's Lars Bo Kaspersen, director of the Center for Business and Politics at Copenhagen Business School. Kaspersen says the Danish flex security model, which is admired by other EU nations, is being tested by the current crisis. Danes and other Europeans say they have faith in their social welfare systems, but there is a realization across the EU that sacrifices must be made to preserve the European social model. The one thing that no one seems to want is an American-style, mostly private system. Europeans looked on in horror when American retirees lost their life savings in collapsed pension funds and the unemployed lost their houses and health care. So Europeans are doing their best to keep their system afloat. Jacques Attali is advising the French government on ways to rein in healthcare spending.
We may be very proud of our system, and we have not the slightest intention to change it, and we can afford it. What we have to do is just to have a small adjustment of 1% of our GDP. 1% of our spending is not a lot of money. We will do it.
But not everyone is so sure. The European Union, say Europeans, was built on three pillars: peace, growth, and a shared social vision. If one of those pillars collapses, how long will the other two remain standing? For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
Until pretty recently, Spain was the biggest job creator among the 16 European nations that use the euro as their common currency. But the world financial crisis has dealt a devastating blow to Spain's economy. The country now has a 20% jobless rate, the highest in the eurozone, and drastic cuts in government spending are only adding to anxiety about the future. As part of our series this week on the challenges to European unity, NPR's Silvia Pajoli reports from Madrid.
In the Moratalaz neighborhood, lines start forming outside the local unemployment office at 7 a.m., 2 hours before the doors open. 30-year-old Gloria Morigosa just lost her job as a secretary.
The situation is very hard.
And who do you blame?
El consumismo.
Consumerism?
Creo que hemos basado la sociedad en el consumismo.
People who had not many resources, financial resources, spent a lot of money more than they had. They asked for a lot of credit, and with the real estate boom, they thought they could spend a lot of money.
Over the last decade, Spain was the European Union poster child. It had it all: great weather, movie star Penelope Cruz, and the trendiest cuisine. It was all part of the boom that followed adoption of the single currency, the euro, in 1999, that was hailed as a major step in European unity. Economist Juan José Dolado explains some of the euro's effects on the Spanish economy.
All of a sudden, we adopted German interest rates. The single currency, single interest rate. We became alike, the Germans. So interest rates went down a lot. So investment became very profitable. So it made sense to specialize on bricks, as we say, sand and bricks. This is our industrial specialization.
Foreign capital flowed in, especially from Germany and the UK, and the construction boom was unprecedented. Spain had a budget surplus for 3 years in a row and created 5 million new jobs. In 2006, there were more housing starts in Spain than in the UK, Germany, France, and Italy combined. Cheap money brought a burst of self-confidence and a consumption binge. But the economic crisis in 2008 burst the bubble, and 2.5 million jobs have since been wiped out. Spaniards found themselves with more than 1 million unsold new housing units and no manufacturing base to fall back on. Nowhere is that more obvious than at the household appliance floor of Madrid's big department store, El Corte Inglés.
Look at the names we see here. Bosch, Siemens, Mielis, Meg, AEG. They're all German names. I can't find one appliance made in Spain.
Economist Dolado says that prior to adopting the euro, Spain, like many other countries on Europe's periphery, never had a strong export industry, but it could sell easily abroad by devaluing its local currency. With the euro, that's no longer possible. And so, while southern Europeans focused on untradeable goods like housing and services, they lost competitiveness. And the heavily industrialized and efficient Germany became the biggest exporter in Europe.
So the rest of the countries lost ground. They couldn't export so much. They incurred in big current account deficit, etc.
The European Union has so far been unable to establish a unified fiscal policy to control its unified currency, with each country following its individual financial policies. National debts have ballooned, now threatening the stability of the euro. In response to the crisis, EU countries have announced radical budget-cutting measures. Spain aims to cut more than $18 billion over 2 years. The IMF is also demanding a radical overhaul of the Spanish labor market. It's a two-tier system like those in Italy, Greece, and Portugal, where full-time employees enjoy nearly job-for-life guarantees, and a second-class group of workers, mostly poorly paid young people, have short-term contracts with few or no benefits. In Spain, they're called the Ni-Ni generation. They have neither money, nor homes, nor career. Unemployment among Spanish young tops 40%.
Barreto, con B y dos R.
These young men gather at a youth center in a working-class section of Madrid. Like most Spanish youth, they live with their parents. It's a system called the cushion, the unofficial safety net for the younger generation. Raúl Rivas is 20 and has been in and out of many jobs.
We all want to be independent and have our own place, but the conditions don't exist. We cannot dream of renting a room with five other people. We just can't afford it.
Spain's big construction boom attracted large numbers of young males. 30% even dropped out of high school in order to start making money. Most of them are now jobless. 20-year-old Manuel Rodriguez is the only one here still studying at university.
Today, a degree doesn't mean a thing. It doesn't guarantee you a job. It doesn't matter if you study or not. I certainly feel like I'm part of a lost generation.
Across southern Europe, this lost generation has trouble entering the job market, has insecure jobs with few chances of improving skills, and has to postpone starting a family. A recent Spanish newspaper headline, From Baby Boom to Baby Crash, announced that Spain's birth rate, already low, had dropped 5% in 2009 over the previous year. Today's young will be carrying the burden of an aging society. Sociologist Antonio López Peláez says Spain, like other Mediterranean countries with low birth rates, is no country for young men.
The welfare state in Spain focuses on health and the elderly. It's families that support young people, and there are more resources for the elderly than child care centers.
This is the trend throughout the Eurozone South, where patriarchal societies still count. Majorities of young people up to 34 years of age still live with their families. In Portugal, youth unemployment, like in Spain, is twice the national average. And in Italy, 2 million young people between 15 and 29 did not work or study in 2009, making it the European country with the highest number of inactive youth. Economist Dolado says if Southern Europe is to remain a player in the European Union, it must learn from its northern partners, where there is good job training for the unemployed and young people.
Education and labor market are the two key reforms that this country needs. The power is in the brain these days, not any longer in the hands, as it used to be in the past.
But the path to recovery and growth will be long and difficult. And the legacy of having adopted the euro straitjacket for many on the European periphery could prove to be hardships for an entire generation. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News.
When Jacob Lew finished his first tour as White House budget director in 2001, he left behind a budget surplus of $237 billion. Now President Obama has nominated Lew to take a second swipe at the job, and the circumstances could scarcely be more different. Lew will face a budget deficit of some $1.3 trillion and decisions that will be difficult, to say the least. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
President Obama had high praise for 54-year-old Jacob Jack Lew as he announced his choice for director of the Office of Management and Budget at the White House yesterday.
If there was a Hall of Fame for budget directors, then Jack Lew surely would have earned a place for his service in that role under President Clinton.
Liu would succeed Peter Orszag, who announced his resignation last month. Under President Clinton, Liu oversaw 3 years of budget surpluses after years of deficits.
He's going to have to reproduce a lot of that magic again this time.
That's Barbara Chow, who worked with Liu at the OMB in the Clinton administration. Now at the Hewlett Foundation, Chow says Liu was one of the best OMB directors ever, smart and collaborative.
OMB is often a kind of a job, I think, where it feels a little bit like it's just telling everybody no. But it's actually a job, when done well, I think, where the person at the helm is bringing together a lot of disparate points of view into something that is a coherent administration policy. And Jack is superb at doing this.
As budget director, Liu's first task would be to draw up the administration's next budget plan, usually unveiled in February. The always arduous process will be especially challenging this time, as Liu will face some seemingly intractable problems. Stubbornly high unemployment and the lingering effects of the recession mean revenues are down. Spiraling health care costs and baby boomer retirements mean that Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid make up an ever-growing part of the federal budget, and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan demand billions of dollars in defense spending. Before beginning his first stint at OMB in the 1990s, Liu served as deputy director under Alice Rivlin. Rivlin says the next Obama budget will be extremely important.
The president has said he wants to focus not only on getting the economy moving, but on bringing down the long-run deficit. So here's the chance in this next budget to show that he can do two things at once, and to convince the Congress that he has a sensible plan to bring the deficit down.
Rivlin serves on the president's Deficit Reduction Commission, which is looking into those long-term deficit issues. It's due to issue its report December 1st. Liu was part of a negotiating team that reached a bipartisan agreement with Congress on a balanced budget in the 1990s, and he remains respected on both sides of the aisle. One of the Senate Republicans on the Budget Committee at that time was New Hampshire's Judd Gregg. Now the senior Republican on the Budget Committee, Gregg says he'll support Liu's nomination, calling him thoughtful, smart, and capable.
He's taking on a job, however, where the numbers don't match up. I mean, this administration is running up massive spending and massive debt. And it's really the job of the OMB director to say the emperor has no clothes. And that's the situation today.
One element in any plan will have to be the tax cuts that were enacted under President George W. Bush and that expire January 1st. The administration clearly plans to let taxes rise on at least some incomes as a result, but the president also promised in his campaign not to raise taxes on anyone making less than $250,000 a year. Liu's confirmation hearings are expected to begin this fall. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.